It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Iowa Week on both of our talk shows, a time for us to do a little something different all week long on Talk of Iowa and here on River to River. This Iowa Week, our theme is Then and Now. We're focusing on major changes that have taken place over the past, oh, I'd say century or so, in all kinds of areas: parenting, diversity, political discourse, food and nutrition, education. Also look at medical advances. This hour, we're focusing on jobs. Now, it would be hard to find a type of work that hasn't changed quite a bit over the decades, but this hour, we're picking a few lines of work that have experienced some interesting change in the past few generations, and starting off with a line of work I know very well that has been altered dramatically: journalism. Joining me to chat about that is Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent, longtime host of Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press, I think, since 1971. And Dean, welcome to this little round table. You've interviewed every president, I understand, going back to what president?
Dwight Eisenhower.
Amazing. Okay.
I noticed you emphasized long time.
Well, by any definition, going back to Eisenhower is long time. You'll have to cope with that, Dean Borg. Steve Barry is with us as well in our Iowa City studio, co-founder and advisor for the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, iowawatch.org. He's also professor emeritus of journalism at the University of Iowa. 33 years of work as a print journalist, ending at the Los Angeles Times in 1993. Steve won a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. Great to have you on board as well, Steve.
Thank you, man. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Sarah McCammon, there's a voice that we are hearing, thankfully, on our airwaves, a political reporter now for NPR, covering the 2016 election. Formerly Iowa Public Radio Morning Edition host and reporter, 12 years of experience in broadcast news. Great to have you on board, Sarah.
It's great to be back on IPR, Ben. Thanks.
Let me start off with Dean and Steve. Steve, print journalism, let's talk about what you see as the biggest changes since you started off in your first decade of journalism, which would have been when?
Oh, 1970 was my first year in journalism as a reporter. That was for the Dothan, Alabama Eagle in southeast Alabama.
So that would have been when?
That would have been July 1970.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so take us through quickly a work day in a print journalist's life in 1970. Technology much different, the way of working much different.
Oh, it was so different. We were still on manual typewriters at that time. My day was out on the beat. I stayed out on the beat as long as I could. The editor said he did not want to see my face in the newsroom until 3:30 or 4 o'clock, when I'm supposed to come in and start knocking out my stories on the typewriter. And then we got really big time 3 or 4 years later when we went to electric typewriters and things that were called telecopiers, which were glorified bulky fax machines that we carried around. And we would transmit stories by pulling up to the nearest phone, sometimes phone booths, and plugging in the telephone into the saddle on the telecopier, sticking our typewritten paper into the roller, pushing a button, and sending the story over the telephone lines. And the biggest technological challenge back then was to get a story through without a telephone interruption. The second biggest challenge was finding a telephone, especially if you were on a political campaign. Green reporters, like I was on my first, covering my first presidential candidate, you had to fight for a telephone, and you would learn all sorts of tricks to reserve a telephone, from paying somebody to pretend they were using the telephone so they would reserve it for you. And I learned that lesson pretty quickly.
So the kind of Hollywood thing that's often made fun of is reporters running into a mass of telephone booths. They were actually staked out for real.
I didn't do it, but I learned other reporters doing it.
Dean Borg.
The epitome of that, excuse me for breaking in, during the Kennedy assassination, the motorcade, one of the limousines behind the presidential limousine was Jack Bell of the Associated Press and Merriman Smith of UPI. They fought over that telephone, that radio telephone that was in that car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dean Borg, give us a glimpse of broadcast journalism now that Steve has told us a little bit about the way print journalism used to be. Broadcast journalism decades ago, a typical day or a stark example of how it's changed from your experience?
Well, I could talk about technology, and I did much the same thing because there was broadcast journalism grew out of print. And so we had much the same equipment, only we were over the airwaves, but we had much the same equipment as we evolved. But I can remember a lot going down to Western Union and filing stories, hard copy that I'd typed out, and then using Western Union to transmit them back to the station or if I was reporting for the Associated Press or United Press International, that's how they would get the story from me, too. The other thing that I would bring in here is human relations. We wouldn't have Sarah McCammon in this program here if it weren't for what happened in the late 1960s, but mostly early 70s. Our newsrooms were exclusively male.
Yep.
And I can remember when we brought on our first African-American and woman journalist into our newsroom in which I was working at that time. And you might, the word was token, but I don't think our newsroom did it for a token reason. We needed to expand, and we needed to bring in those voices.
Now with that diversity, coming minorities entering the newsroom, women taking a bigger role in the newsrooms across the country, did that change the reporting, the type of stories that you could tell right off the bat? Steve, you experienced that same era of white men only in the newsroom, pretty much.
Close, but even in my first year in 1970, there was at least one woman, and she I wouldn't call her token either. She was a very hard-hitting, a very aggressive City Hall reporter.
But I think that was more true in print than it was in broadcast.
So, yeah.
Because in broadcast, there was the voice, number one, and number two, it was the appearance on television. And I'll even name a name. I wish I could speak again with Linda Hudson, who was brought on as that first woman journalist in the newsroom in which I was working at that time. She lasted maybe at the most 4 months before upper management said, no, she has her hair blowing in her eyes when she's out doing a report on television. And this wasn't a live shot. This was on film, of course. But her hair is blowing into her eyes. And one morning I came to work and Linda Hudson was no longer there. She was an excellent journalist. But the person who was then hired to replace her had won a beauty contest.
Mm. Dean Borg with us. If you've just joined us, Steve Barry, a longtime journalist. We're reflecting on how journalism used to be, how it's changed over the years. Sarah McCammon is with us as well. And Sarah, you've been listening to us as we pursue Iowa Week, our theme then and now. And while we're talking about gender equality in the newsroom, you came on board after the year 2000. So a lot of these changes had thankfully taken place, and women are thankfully well represented, especially in the public media. Was there any gender differences when you entered the fray there, Sarah?
I mean, I don't know what it was like before. I was born, sorry, Dean, but 10 years after you started hosting Iowa Press. I do come to it from a different perspective. I mean, I think when you look at the media industry as a whole, women still are not in leadership positions, in particular at the rate that women are not in leadership positions at the rate that men are. I feel in public media, especially, I've been very fortunate. I've had lots of opportunities and worked with wonderful colleagues, both men and women. I have no complaints, but I think as a whole, the industry, still has work to do on that front. And in terms of when you look at diversity in a number of levels, gender, race, life experience, I think we need to constantly be having those conversations because different people bring different perspectives into their storytelling, maybe ask questions that, someone else wouldn't ask. And so, I think it's good for all of us. It's good for our democracy if our newsrooms look like our country.
Sarah, let me ask you, listeners will certainly be interested in your sort of work routine, if I can put it the way, how you get the stories on the air that we hear and the tools of the trade that you have now in 2015. What are the indispensable tools of your trade? How do you pursue a story? What are you doing?
Well, in terms of the technical tools, they're definitely different than what, for instance, Steve was talking about. I have been a journalist for 12 years. I should mention my first year and a half or so was at a newspaper. And that was 2003. So obviously we had the internet, but it wasn't as evolved and mature as it is now. I remember filing stories, print stories, sometimes through a cell phone, because that was before wireless technology was ubiquitous. But, you know, today, instead of fighting for telephone booths with other reporters, I'm sometimes fighting for, broadband access. Everybody's getting on their laptops at the same time, say at the Cleveland Republican presidential debate. You had a room full of reporters and everybody's trying to get online. And it wasn't too bad. But, you know, that's sort of the modern analog to that. I take two recorders everywhere I go because you learn quickly that you want to have backups when you're on the road, extra gear, extra batteries, all of that stuff. But I think more importantly, probably the most indispensable tool, and this is not a tangible tool, but I think the most important thing for a journalist, whatever medium you're working in, whatever tools you're working with, whatever era you're working in, is curiosity. And asking questions, however you're producing the story, it's got to be a good story, and it's got to be a story that speaks to people and is relevant and important. And I think it's important to just be, always letting your thoughts brew, looking for trends, bouncing hunches off of colleagues, off of friends. And so I think that's the most important tool for a journalist. It's really your brain.
It's a constant that's gone through the generations. Dean Borg, you want to jump in?
Well, she and we've been talking about fighting for telephone booths and for internet access. I recall, and I'm glad we aren't in those days right now, but when if you had to ship, unless you could find a telephone and had the apparatus in order to transmit radio signals, and you couldn't television over the telephone lines. I did over the telephone lines from the Iowa legislature, but you would have to know plane schedules and ship film or audio tape, either by bus or by film, back to the station. From South Vietnam, for example, now you would uplink to a satellite.
Reported from South Vietnam?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there was shipping film out of South Vietnam to Hong Kong, back to Los Angeles, where it was processed, and then would be transmitted to CBS News in New York over cable from there. But always from Des Moines or in place in Iowa, you were looking, if you couldn't drive back quickly enough, you would have to ship it by bus or find United Airlines or Ozark Airlines at that time flying from Des Moines to Cedar Rapids or Tumwa to Cedar Rapids or whatever it was.
Mm, very interesting. Glimpse into the past. We're looking at journalism then and now here on Iowa Week with Dean Borg, Steve Barry, and Sarah McCammon. Of course, the advent of the internet changed everything. Steve, you're reminding me, your pad of paper trotting around town in your first newspaper reporting in the early 1970s and coming back, of course, no such thing as the internet the early 1970s. That's changed things tremendously in terms of researching quickly, the speed with which you can access pertinent information for a report.
In my day, when I was assigned to go cover a candidate who would fly into whatever county or city I was working in, I would spend hours researching that candidate's past positions and preparing for it, writing questions out in advance to anticipating his responses. And I had to do all of that in advance. So when he came and I had a chance to interview him, I would be prepared to ask him tough questions. Mm-hmm. I would know when he is lying or giving me misinformation. Now, thanks to the wonderful world of the internet, you can do that kind of preparation almost on deadline. And I think as we learned in our political caucus class several years ago, you can actually do fact-checking on deadline thanks to the Internet. And I think that is something that political reporting needs to start doing more, not just with fact-check stories that you see in the Washington Post, quite, but you need to be doing it on the campaign trail, on deadline, and when a politician lies or misinforms or distorts something, a political reporter is in an easy position to make that correction and to insert pertinent information.
Mm-hmm. I think one other thing, it reminds me of what you're saying there, reminds me what's changed in security, too. Within the past few days, I heard Sarah McCammon reporting from the U.S. State Department in Washington, D.C. I wondered what credentials she had to have to get into that briefing. But it reminded me that now to get into a political campaign, Hillary Clinton's, you have to pass through metal detectors and things like that, and they have bomb-sniffing dogs. Not all candidates have that level of security, and it's because she's a former first lady that she has that security. But go back to the mid-1960s, when in Davenport, Iowa, I stood up on the back of a flatbed truck when Bobby Kennedy was delivering a campaign speech there. I was only maybe 5 feet away from the candidate, standing up on a flatbed truck along with him. And that was routine in covering in those days. You cannot do that now.
Mm. Sarah McCammon, let me ask you about how you use social media in your reporting. We use it to get our word of our news, our reports out, NPR and Iowa Public Radio. But tell us how you use sites like Twitter, services like Facebook in your daily work.
I mean, it's really just kind of a, I would say, seamlessly integrated into my day. And, you know, the other tool that I should have mentioned is phones, you know, cell phones. And we have the Internet, obviously, at our fingertips. And as Steve said, it's very helpful because you can go online and, you know, confirm a fact, check a fact, find out what, especially with 17 candidates on the GOP side, it's helpful to have the Internet at your fingertips to just sort of refresh your memory on what they've said and where they're going and those kinds of things. Twitter is probably the most valuable social media site for me as a reporter because it lets me, you know, follow the news. I can't be everywhere all the time, so I know what other reporters and newsmakers are talking about. Find sources. I've used it to put out a call for, you know, I need this sort of person. I need a farmer in Eastern Iowa, whatever. Even to connect with sources. I did a few weeks in Iowa working for Marketplace a couple years back and on very tight deadlines every day. And sometimes Twitter was actually the fastest way to reach someone. You just tweet them and say, hey, I need to talk to you. And a lot of people, you know, are checking their Twitter constantly, maybe even more than they check their email or certainly their voicemail. I also use it in breaking news situations to stay up to date on what's going on. I covered the Charleston shootings for NPR in June, and one of the first things I did was go online and follow the local police department and other agencies like that, the governor, of course, and I turn on notifications. So if anybody tweets, you know, from a key agency, I get a notification and I know what they're saying in case there's new information or an announcement of a press conference or something like that. I use it, too, to share, you know, what's going on, things that might not make it into a story. I was at a rally for Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders a couple weeks ago in South Carolina covering that and put a video out on Vine, which is, of course, Twitter's video service, just of people cheering, you know, just a little moment that might not make it into the story. But it's nice to be able to share. It also helps me with my reporting because sometimes I go back and I look at what I tweeted and whatever stuck out to me as an interesting moment on Twitter sometimes is an interesting moment for a radio story or a web story, a good quote, you know, that jumps out. So it helps me organize my thoughts and it helps me kind of capture the moment as I go along. I really use that sometimes in place of maybe a notebook.
We have a few minutes left. Sarah McCammon, Dean Borg, and Steve Barry. I wanted to have us cast our glance forward and get your thoughts with your long views in the past. Steve Barry, where do you see journalism heading in the future? Now so many things are different. The aspect when we didn't talk about is the public is much more involved mm-hmm. in producing journalism. You can, through the power of the Internet, become a blogger and do this thing not in a traditional way.
Right. Yeah, the public is citizen journalism. I prefer to call it, because I think it's a more accurate term, amateur journalism, is increasing quite a bit, and it's become very useful. We treasure input from citizens, and because of the electronic media, because of the internet, and blogs and so forth, we have more ready access to our readers, to our viewers and listeners, and their input is good. My only warning is that I do worry in the future that people, when they get their news from amateur journalists, they really need to understand what they are getting. There is a reason we have journalism. There's a reason we call it journalism. There's a reason we have journalism schools. And citizen amateur journalists do not have those kind of fact-checking, the curiosity that Sarah was talking about a while ago. They do not have those skills that vet the news that they get with their cameras and they get that they put on their blogs. Mm-hmm. We do that.
Okay. We have a very short time left to go. Dean Borg, some concluding remarks?
Well, I would just say that my worry about the future is that we do not go to too much superficial journalism. Mm-hmm. And because the informed American electorate will suffer if we do.
Sarah McCammon, a few words from you to end this fascinating conversation.
You know, the internet makes our jobs easier in a lot of ways, a lot more efficient. And I do think that the presence of citizen or amateur journalists can help inform what we're doing. I think, though, that I trust at least that people want to know, with all the information out there, who they can trust and what information they can trust. And that's where we come in as journalists, with that role, as Steve said, of vetting information and fact-checking and providing analysis. And, you know, I think our listeners on NPR and Iowa Public Radio seem to really appreciate that and value that. And my hope is just that going forward, Americans will continue to see the importance of that for a functioning democracy.
Sarah McCammon, currently political reporter at NPR, formerly of Iowa Public Radio, Morning Edition host. Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Steve Barry, currently co-founder and advisor for the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, iowawatch.org, professor emeritus of journalism at the University of Iowa. What a round of interesting insights, Steve, Dean, and Sarah. A glimpse into the past, into the current, and a little bit into the future.
Enjoyed the conversation, Ben.
Thank you all.
I did too.
Thank you very much.
I don't bear, now tell me, what's in the headline today? Will it be?
And coming up after a short break, Iowa Week continues with former Des Moines Police Chief Judy Bradshaw. She'll tell us how law enforcement has changed in the past three decades. Then I visit a blacksmith in Kelowna to hear how that trade has endured into the 21st century. When we come back, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of this Iowa Week edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. All this week, exploring the theme of change, how certain aspects of our lives have changed over the decades, and we're calling our theme Then and Now. This hour, we've been focusing on jobs, conversations about certain lines of work that have changed in very interesting ways. And there are so many jobs and so many changes to these jobs, we certainly can't get to all of them. But still to come later this hour, what you might call a fairy tale trade that's still around today in the 21st century, we'll meet a blacksmith from Kelowna. But first, law enforcement. Police work has changed dramatically in many ways in recent decades. Joining us to talk about that, Judy Bradshaw, director of the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy, also former Des Moines police chief. She retired from that position in late 2014 after a career of 34 years, seven of them as chief of police in Des Moines. Judy Bradshaw, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us in a nutshell, what are the biggest changes you saw during your career from about 1980 to the present?
Probably the first thing that comes to mind is technology. You know, when I first came on the job 34 years ago, you had a basic police radio that you carried on your belt. That still is true today. And of course, the police radio in the car. But now, you know, your typical police squad car has a computer inside that, you know, communication with your dispatchers is different. The radio, the airtime is how we refer to it, is less because the officers in the cars are communicating through the technology of the computers, the camera systems. You know, I came on and was on the street before the video technology of cell phones and, you know, cameras in the police cars. So, you know, there's just a lot more that's captured in the public in general, not just by law enforcement, you know, vehicles and body cameras and again, the car cameras, but by the public, you know, through cell phones, businesses that have camera systems that are available to them. And I see that as continuing. That's just going to, you know, become more enhanced as the next level of technology advances. And who knows what that might be, you know. Yeah.
How has all this technology changed the way police operate? You're talking about not only the police having more technology, but the public at large having more technology.
Well, for instance, the crimes have changed. It used to be prostitution, for instance. You know, the prostitutes were on the street, and that's how they would access their clients, if you will. And now that's all been moved indoors, and it's done through the internet, and the contacts are made, you know, online, and it keeps them off the streets, but it's also harder to go after. We did just see in the local metro area through the state fair that there was a sting operation that focused on the internet. So there's ways for law enforcement to adjust to the crimes of the internet. You know, cyber bullying that didn't exist, you know, 30 years ago when I came on. It was, everything was done face to face or in the written word. Now it's done on the internet and, you know, on texting and through cell phones. You know, just someone taking and the act of robbing, you know, it used to be a face-to-face interaction. Well, now through a keyboard, you know, you can have parts of your account that are emptied, mm-hmm. you know, by the right person. So, you know, the crimes have shifted to the internet. So where there's technology, there's going to be bad guys out there that are going to find a way, you know, to either enhance their trade or to create a trade of fraud or crime through that technology. And law enforcement at all levels have to, you know, we have to be ready to train for that and to respond to it.
Now, in some situations, police forces, local police forces, can now resemble military units in their gear and their equipment. Did that trend start with the post 9/11 world we live in?
You know, I would attribute it to that in part. But, you know, law enforcement, if historically, if you look at how law enforcement has acquired equipment and technology, the military really they're the pioneers as far as camera systems and intelligence tracking kinds of devices, night vision, weaponry. It really is introduced in the military first, which is as it should be. And then what happens is when that is finally allowed to be introduced to the public, that level of technology, law enforcement then is able to look at it and examine it for its value. You know, is this camera system something that we can benefit from? Is this level of weaponry or nighttime vision or whatever tactical gear that is used by the military, is that something that might enhance our capabilities on the street?
Mm-hmm.
And we have to balance that. I mean, I think that that's what the community is seeing today. They don't want to see officers dressed as though they belong in Afghanistan or Beirut. You know, they still want officers to resemble, you know, the traditional approachable, you know, police officer, and,
right.
and not view them as military soldiers that are patrolling the streets. And so, you know, I think most law enforcement executives get that. They understand that. And, you know, you want to take advantage of the technology because you really don't know when you might use that kind of technology that's available. And if it enhances the safety of your officers, then you know what, I'm all for that. And but at the same time, I recognize that there has to be a balance there.
With police being in the news the last couple of years, not always in flattering ways, police brutality, race relations a question here, do you see that changing the way police work in terms of concentrating more on community relations, for example?
Yes. You know, Ferguson and the series of events that have happened after Ferguson is going to change the way that police officers are trained. There are different approaches now to training and providing more of a holistic foundation, you know, that looks at the physical, emotional, spiritual, and the mental side of officers. And, you know, the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy, we are looking to adopt a particular approach that I hope to roll out later this year. I'm just going to allude to it a little bit, but I have to get, you know, the key Sheriff's Association, Chiefs of Police Association, I have to do some groundwork here and build the foundation for support first. And I know it's going to be there. But our training is going to be more holistic, and we're going to get away from the warrior mentality. And I'm not saying that all law enforcement has that warrior mentality, but there is sort of a piece and a part of that that views local officers as warriors, and really gear our cultures and our mentality towards a guardianship that looks at you know, more of a balanced, deliberate approach to things, you know, mm-hmm. Not training to the extremes, you know, because most officers don't hit the extreme in their day-to-day routine of activities and their duties. You know, they're not going to approach a car and someone's going to pull a gun on them. Now, they have to be aware of that, and they have to be cognizant that it's high risk. However, 98% of the time, it's going to work out for you. You're not going to be faced with a weapon or a gun or even resistance. And even when officers do face resistance in Iowa, you know, the person's not trying to take that officer's life. They're just trying to flee. They're trying to get out of their situation. They're not willing to kill in order to escape. You know, they're going to run from you. They're going to jump out of the car. They may not stop for you right away, but they're, you know, in 95%, research has shown, of those situations, they're not trying to kill the police officer or any citizen. They're just not complying with the officer's actions. So, you know, we have to begin to talk about, you know, what the norm is, but yet also training that officer to be ready for the 5% or the 2% of the situations where someone is trying to kill them.
Mm-hmm. Judy Bradshaw, before we go, I have to ask you about this. You became Des Moines' first female police chief. You must have seen a lot of change in terms of gender equity since we think of law enforcement as traditionally a male domain. Can you recall an instance or can you track not being treated fairly because you were a woman and how that's changed over 30-plus years?
Well, you know, when I first came on 34 years ago, there was a sentiment that among the officers that, you know, if we wait the women out, things could go back to normal because they're trying this on, you know. And if we wait it out, then it's just going to be us guys. But there was also a lot of supporters. You know, they weren't as vocal. And, you know, you could tell that there were a lot of men that were skeptical. And so those of us that came on, you know, 30, 35 years ago, we had to prove ourselves, and we had to show that we could make it on the street in particular in those tough situations, that we didn't need a protector, that the you did get a lot of that. You had officers that would show up because they were concerned that whether or not you could handle a particular call. And but as time, you know, has passed and women have proven that they can handle the street duty, the ruggedness of the trenches, if you will, of handling domestics and fights and shootings and you know. I was just talking this morning with a colleague of mine that when I first came on, I was one of very few women. There were two of us on the midnight shift. And I remember hearing a conversation between my sergeant and another sergeant. They were trying to assign officers, and they said, well, we can't put those two on the same side of town, you know, so let's put her over on the east side, and we'll put the other one on the west side. There was this mindset that, you know, the women couldn't work side by side because that would weaken that squad in that area, and you needed to sort of move them around. And, you know, as the department hired more women, And as I became promoted, you know, that conversation went away. You had women working as what we call two-man cars, and we still refer to them as men, but they're personnel, two people in a car, two females. That happens, and so the conversation about weakness, can they handle it,
right,
it's gone away.
Is gender now not considered in any way in terms of who takes what assignment? Can you say that for sure?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I back in the day, though, they didn't work robbery, homicide. That was a man's job. You worked more the juvenile cases and cases involving female offenders. You wouldn't think of putting a woman in the tactical unit, you know, where there's an entry team and snipers and, you know, chemical munitions being deployed. Well, I was the lieutenant, the tactical commander for several years, and then I was as a captain, I was in charge of the special operations, which is overseas attack unit. So, and we had a female sniper. And so I've seen how a lot of the milestones and the ceiling has been broke, at least at the Des Moines Police Department. And we've got female detectives in the robbery homicide unit within the Des Moines Police Department. Some of the best ones are some of the women. And it's just not based on their gender. It's based on their ability to work really hard.
Judy Bradshaw, what an enlightening conversation. You've taken us over decades to see how law enforcement has changed over the years. Currently director of the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy, former Des Moines Police Chief, Judy Bradshaw. Thanks for this conversation.
You bet. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Iowa Week on both of our talk shows. Time for us to dance to a little different tune all week long on Talk of Iowa and here on River to River. This Iowa Week, our theme is Then and Now. We're focusing on major changes that have taken place over the past century or so in all kinds of areas: parenting, diversity, political discourse, food and nutrition, education, medical advances, all this week. This hour, we're focusing on jobs. We're picking a few lines of work that have experienced tremendous change in the past few generations. For this part of the program, I've taken a little road trip with our producer, Emily Woodbury, to the southeast Iowa town of Kelowna. And I'm standing outside of Kelowna Blacksmith and Welding, where the owner is Bob Yoder.
This building appears to be here since about 1915. So it's 100 years old, best we can tell. I've got equipment here that I'm not sure how old it is. This one right behind you, I'm guessing, is pre-World War I, I think. I'm making an educated guess. Then I've got my portable welding rig that was new last year. I have everything from, I'm guessing, some of the stuff is probably 100 years old to brand new in here as far as equipment.
Part of your shop is taken up by this huge machine that it looks like it comes out maybe from an era several generations ago. What is that, Bob?
This is a Williams & White, what would be the predecessor of what today is called an iron worker. And to get technical about it, it's an overdriven mechanical machine. And what that means is the gears are overhead. It has a flywheel on it, and the flywheel is what gives you the inertia to get your tonnage. That's what actually does the work. It's like a flywheel on a car or an old tractor or anything like that. That was the technology they had before hydraulics was in place. And that's how once you got that flywheel going and then you engaged it, that's what drove the machine. The biggest thing is these things basically are about indestructible. They last forever.
So, Bob, you've started up the machine here. Give us an idea of how much power what you just described has.
It's 50 ton. When you engage the clutch, 50 ton of force is coming down. The thing you have to remember is you can't stop it. Once you engage the clutch, it makes it cycle. So if your finger's in the way or your dies aren't adjusted right, something's wrong, you will hear a lot of crunching and whatever else. And you'll have a real mess. And you don't want any part of that one. And that's why when I set up a new die to punch holes, I always cycle it before I start it, because you want to make sure everything's working the way it's supposed to be, or you will have consequences that you won't like.
And has that ever happened to you?
No, I want no part of that one.
So list off some of the projects that you typically do here. What kind of projects? Tell me.
I've got one with your name on. This is one that I run into about once or twice a year. The bell they brought me, but they did not have the yoke. They had lost the yoke.
Okay, this is a beautiful iron bell. Looks to be about 2 feet in diameter, right? Something like that. And that dates from when, you think?
I would guess that's pre-World War II, and it could be pre-World War I. I'm not sure.
And this is, someone brought this to you to repair?
A lady brought it to me, and I think, I'm not totally sure, I think it was a family heirloom, and she didn't have this yoke here. And you have the yoke here, and then this piece would fit on a post. And that's what I made for, so she can mount that on a post and ring it.
That is nice. That is a nice clang.
That's one of the better bells I've ever had in here for a ring.
So I understand you've been in blacksmithing some 30 years. How did you first get into it?
I got my welding experience, and where I started was Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I also went to a pipe welding school in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I had about 4 years of experience working for other people before I bought this business. And I came here in 1984. There's very few businesses in town that have been here longer than me. There's a few, but I'm getting to be one of the older businesses here.
What is it you like most about your welding and your blacksmithing work here?
It's something different all the time. You don't get bored in this place. If you'd have told me how fast 31 years were going to go in 1984, I was 29 years old when I bought this. I'm 60 now. I didn't realize how fast the time would go.
Broadly speaking, 31 years in blacksmithing, what are the biggest changes that you've seen?
Washington County is a farm county, very much agriculture oriented. When I first came in here, just about everything I did related to agriculture. Now it could be anything. I do a lot of work in construction, or have in my life, where I used to almost always do something ag related. Over the years, it got to where I did a lot more construction-related projects, and I do have a DOT welding card, or used to have it. I had that for 20-some years. Depending on which bridge you came in on, I worked on it. So things like that.
It sounds like to keep this sort of blacksmithing shop a thriving business over decades, you have to be quick to adapt.
Work that I used to do all the time, I used to repair sickles for the guys' hay mowers. In the summertime, about a third of the work I did, that's what it related to. I don't even do it anymore. Work that I used to do all the time, now I seldom do. What I'm doing a lot more of as time goes on is custom fabrication, like what I'm showing you here, some of these projects. And usually it's something they can't just go out and buy.
So how long do you intend to be in business?
If my health allows it, the best thing I could do, I think health-wise and for myself, is to do the combination. If I could do it till I was 70 or in my mid-70s, I'm going to do it. I don't think I want to retire at 65 or 67. I don't think I want to do that. I'm not ready for that yet.
What about blacksmithing as a career, as a job? Will that go on into the future, keep on adapting, changing, or is it a line of work that's dying out, you think?
Right now, there is a tremendous need for all the skilled trades, welders included. You know, you could kind of lump that in with blacksmithing, but the old basic trades are still in very much in demand. There's actually a big shortage in some areas, depending on where you're at.
All right. Bob Yoder, owner of Kelowna Blacksmith and Welding, been at it for 31 years. Thanks for letting us interrupt your afternoon of work here in Washington County, Bob.
Appreciate you coming down here. Glad to have you.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.